Hey everyone, welcome to episode 26 of the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Coulter. With me, I have the high performance coaches for Metro and Country, Mike Zeppel, Justin Schuler. Welcome, guys.
Hello, Robbie.
G'day.
Episode 26, Robbie. Have a listen to these champion number 26s. In FIFA World Cup starts this Saturday. So in the spirit of soccer, we watch soccer once every 4 years. Number 26, John Terry. Chelsea captain, English captain, you both do not know who that is, nope. But he was a very good soccer player back in, or football player back in the day.
Listen to the accent as well.
How's about these? Ready? Kyle Korver, number 26. Splash. Hedo Turkoglu, number 26. Hey. Judd Bushler, number 26, when he was at the Phoenix Suns. Okay. And then we'll go AFL. Nicky Del Santo, he was a very good 26. Gavin Brown, captain of Collingwood, that's for Wally, number 26. The best one of them all, Tom Hawkins, number 26, three-time premiership player for the Geelong Cats. And Sav Rocker, a bit of a dual sport athlete, went over to, and played in the NFL for a little bit.
I don't know which Rocker it was, but I saw one of those guys down near towards Bonnie Dean last week. I couldn't pick which one it was.
It was one. It might have been Sav, who was a very good number 26. So get on with the show, Robbie.
Yeah, you've done well. That's some fairly solid research by you once again. A little bit too much of a Collingwood theme, which is not appreciated. Like, we did just spend last week at the Hangar down in Essendon and backed it up with a win.
Helped them get a win, so absolutely. That was good.
We will take credit for it, even though it has nothing to do with us.
Well done.
So, we have this weekend, we're just coming off the Classic. So, 16s and 18s were at State Basketball Centre. 12s and 14s were down at Dandenong. A couple of things out of that, obviously. Great interaction between all the coaches. It was fantastic to have a lot of coaches come up and say, hey, we listen to the podcasts, you know, can you talk about X, Y, and Z, whatever the case may be. The interaction was fantastic. Mike, the hardest working coach in basketball, Zeppel, was around stadiums all weekend.
Thank you.
Well done, Mike.
Speaking to everyone, which was great. But what were some of the things that you saw out of the Classic that are probably more trending, I suppose, in basketball at the moment?
Trending, Robbie. It's an interesting one. Like, I watched 12s and 14s the whole weekend, and I do think in the gameplay, like, there are issues with how those games are played. If we're talking about player development for the long term, now everyone goes to the Classic and teams want to win that thing really, really badly. That's the first thing. That's
it's
the
a
first
national
thing.
Tournament, so it's,
that's the first
that's
thing
the
you understand.
Apparently it is.
No Queensland teams, no WA teams.
It's called the National Junior Classic.
And just in style of play is interesting, Robbie. And you sit there watching and you try to picture the game and how it would be played if teams did not full court press or full court trap and how that would actually play out. Because I do think at that age group, the teams with the, obviously we know this, like the biggest, most physically present athletes do find the most success at that level. So, and just in watching the games, that's my thought with it. Like, are these teams and athletes being set up for long-term successes in their development based on how they're playing at their clubs?
Yeah. For me, it's also about what about the individual athlete performances. You know, like a couple of the country sides did all right in the 16s bracket, which was, you know, pleasing from our point. But we also know we've got great individual talent in those two groups, and that obviously helps move teams up the tree. So, you know, is it a system or is it actual just individual talent that helps get that result?
Yeah. I'd be really interested, and I haven't put any time, thought or research into this, so if someone out there wants to do it for me, that would be super, and I'll happily take credit for your work. How many of the best players at 14s are still the best player under 18s? Because I'm not sure that they are. I think they normally get overtaken.
A while ago, I actually tracked that back when I was down in Tassie, just to see, you know, who the leading scorers were, the top three, where were they 2 years and 4 years away. And often by 18s, some of those kids just weren't around. Or they were around, but they definitely weren't the kids knocking on national teams and whatnot. So there is a bit of a trend of that. Like, I don't know, it goes back to many of our pods where we're talking about, well, what's the club philosophy? Like, I know with the club that I'm involved with, it was all about winning, you know, and getting the highest possible result this weekend. So, you know, that's a directive and that's what the goal is and whatnot. Interestingly, I think most of the top four teams came out of Victoria in most age groups. I think it was only 18 girls.
Yeah, Forestville got the win there.
The SA got up in that one. But, you know, so, I mean, doesn't mean more to clubs in Victoria than it does interstate. I know when I was in Adelaide, it meant everything to try and win the Classic. So, you know, it's an interesting mindset. And until, you know, you've said before, like that mindset of, well, is it about development? Is it about competition? Is it about a linkage between the two? It's definitely not a linkage right now. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. And I do think it's a conversation that needs to keep taking place. And if we're talking about, we read a great article from written out of Spain this week from the head coach of FC Barcelona, just around how player development, like how does player development at these EuroLeague clubs and European clubs, even if they're not a EuroLeague club, how does that currently sit, given that their best athletes will leave for the NBA? It's probably not as important for them to represent their nation in qualifiers and things like that, because there is the lure of the NBA.
Yeah, the best part of that article was how he spoke about the goal used to be, you know, play for your national league team because that was your best chance of becoming a national team representative. And I think in most leagues around the world, like, that's not the case anymore. It's changed. That's definitely not the case in Australia. That's a huge change and shift for our competitions, even though, like, through Asia and that, there's a lot more representation. But, you know, that focus of your national leagues being able to produce your national team players, likewise your state-based, you know, national events should be about producing national team junior players and so on and so on. Like, the philosophy should be the same the whole way.
The rules also interest me, Robbie, and these are not just Victorian rules. These are rules that go on all around the country, and I suspect even internationally some places too. We say no half-court zone in under 12s and under 14s.
Correct.
However, we will allow a full-court zone, and we will allow a half-court zone press if the top of it, like the 1-2, like the point of it, does stand on the half-court line or the circle or the base of the circle. So it's just interesting that we do allow one, not the other. I actually think that development may occur in a greater scale if you do not allow a full court press, but allow a half court zone, like a genuine 2-3. Like, I think from there, decision making and passing ability and ability to shoot the ball is really challenged. Whereas the full court trapping, pressing 2-2-1 versus a bunch of football players across the front line. It is going to create turnovers, no doubt. But
I've never understood when we said no zone that was only thought of in the half court. I've never understood that, and it's something that I think, you know, if we're serious about from a development point, it has to change. That said, if it is not, that's what it is. Well, then let all of it in. You know, like, I just don't understand where we're part ways on it.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a little bit of history to that. So that was originally brought in just the under-12s, and then I think a season after it got brought in for under-14s. And it was largely to stop teams from not developing athletes, mainly on the defensive end, in all honesty, with having just one big kid that would stand at the rim and not do anything else. And, you know, whether it's worked or not, up for debate, I would probably suggest. And I think with any rule that comes in, good to review it and say, well, okay, has this worked? Has this not worked? Are there any modifications we can make to it?
The part I love about it is there was a thought process. Absolutely. And so, let's try something. I guess my point is under 15s for the Crocs will go away this December.
Yep.
They'll see zone.
Yep.
I promise you, having they'll never see seen zone, it having never played against it a lot at a VJBL level. So are we actually helping our blue chip athletes? And again, we always, on this pod, thing, you know, about the top 1%, because really the top 1%, if you get that part right, every other part gets better anyway. So that's kind of where we're always talking. To me, what does help the best Victorian athlete represent his nation in December? Well, it's having great IQ in all styles of the game. So yeah, to me, that's something probably, you know, and the landscape's changed, so it's always good to keep reviewing.
Absolutely. And kids adapt to it as well. Like, I mean, it's probably kept some kids in the game a little bit longer. It's probably hurt some other kids. It swings around about to, it'll even out eventually. But it is probably something we do need to have a little bit of a look at, and just the thought process behind, because are we making kids better in a 1-2-1-1 arrow press? Like, you might be making your top line of kids better, but the poor kid that keeps having to run back to the foul line that probably doesn't ever see the ball because it always gets trapped and turned over in the front court.
Right.
probably not helping them a whole lot either. Yeah. So, I mean, it's the same zone argument, I suppose. You know, you just got one kid protecting the paint. Does that really improve that kid as well? So I think it's worth a discussion.
One thing quickly on the Classic and all the tournaments over the June long weekend. Like, how good is it that Victoria becomes the just where hoops is? You know, like the amount of people that were flying in Friday morning and, you know, old teammates or friends that, you know, just randomly messaging you around. Like, how many people were in Victoria? That was a real good positive buzz for the sport.
And your response was, no, I'm away for the weekend down at Bonnydoo.
I escaped, exited stage left before Worlds, that's for sure. But,
it is a big weekend. That one and the Australia Day tournament were the two growing up that you did get excited for. Like, we loved going to Bendigo for the long weekend, Australia Day long weekend, and we loved any opportunity to play in a nationally recognised event like the Classic.
It is good. So, great job to all the teams that participated in that, obviously, and the coaches that managed to get through a weekend, which can be stressful. We spoke about it last week, just how they get through it as well. So well done to everyone. It's a tough weekend, and this was usually the Friday night coming up that I hated on my calendar more than anything else. This was usually when you have 6 of your 10 kids available. Of the 6, 4 of them are probably fairly well injured, and it's just a bloodbath on the Friday night. It's scrappy basketball. You're probably playing against another team you likely played the weekend before anyway. It's just horrible basketball, and it's going to be tough for a lot of teams out there. And it's refreshing to hear a couple of the coaches say they're not training this week. And I think that's a really mature approach to take. Your kids have just played 6 or 7 games over a weekend. Do you get anything out of training them again on Tuesday, Wednesday night when they're already broken, bruised, sore? Probably not. I'd probably prefer they get the week off and then play.
There's something also in, you know, having your group peak for when it actually matters. So does the win this Friday night define your season? Probably not. Like, the, you know, your result at Classics is what you were working for. The letdown is going to be there. Let it happen and then get that slow build back up for your run to the finals.
Especially with VC, 10 teams in the competition, 8 of them make finals. Like,
there you go.
You can probably afford to drop one.
I like those odds.
They're looking pretty promising.
On to the top 8.
So just on that, so we've had something come across the desk this week, which was fairly interesting from our end and entertaining as well. An under-12 basketball tournament. Well, actually, it's a junior basketball tournament, so they had all different age groups in it, but we were obviously watching an under-12, which I think is 12 and under.
It should be said, we're going to put this
link into the video.
Like, you gotta,
and
you
some people might have seen it. There was a little highlight clip that popped up on Facebook this week.
Yep.
On Facebook?
No answer.
Is deafening. Yeah, the silence is deafening. Much like all his social media accounts. It says it best when he says nothing at all type thing. So the Torino di Mini Basket. I said that with a horrible Australian accent. Zeppel will probably
Goodness
do it a little bit better.
Me, Robbie.
But we were watching a 12 and under game. It was the Frenchy Phenoms and
Real Madrid.
That's very good. That's fantastic accent you have there. What was interesting was the style of play that these kids had and the feel for the game, the skill sets, the decision making. Like, it was crazy. Like, we probably sat there for about half an hour just going, this is, we don't see this in Australia. And as we've spoken about, like Ian Stacker spoke about it on the podcast, the answers lie in Europe. I think probably collectively in this room we feel the same way with
absolutely.
That the European style is probably closest to the Australian model that we have here in terms of our athletes. The big things, I suppose, out of that, they have a whole bunch of modified rules within this tournament. And we sort of got talking a little bit on what are some of the modifications we can make to our games and training sessions that will enhance player development.
Well, let's hit their modified parts and see if, you know, where we actually genuinely feel about it. Like, the one that I really liked and saw was the ball didn't go to the umpire on that inbound. Like,
really cool.
Kid just ran out of court, inbounded, and you kept playing. Like, the pace of the game was outstanding.
It was incredible. And made it free-flowing.
Yeah.
Like, it's so many times you see, especially now. Like, one thing I did notice is there were no jump balls in there.
Yeah.
Like, and there's no possession arrow work or anything like that. It just, the game just kept going, and it rolled through, and it was incredible speed that it was played at. And exactly that, because they didn't have to check the ball with the umpire, that thing just went.
Yeah, I think it was a running clock game as well. So, you know, obviously we're we're starved of court space and whatnot, but you can still have a great 40-minute game.
Mm.
The possessions are still probably at a similar rate to what's normal because it's not having to be handed to the umpire and then inbound. And I thought that was just a real quick, easy adjustment that can help develop pace.
Absolutely. Yeah.
A little bit of context with this. So we'll put it online, like you said, Robbie, but a really good event. So Real Madrid send a 2006-born group. So that's where this clip is from, or this game is from. So it is 12 and unders, so who would essentially be our bottom age under 14 kids here in Australia. Real Madrid send a team. Alba Berlin, who I know Justin spent a lot of time with, send a 2006-born team. Bayern Munich, who's another German power, and Tenerife also send a team there. So it's a 12-team competition, but a lot of these EuroLeague clubs and EuroCup clubs are sending junior teams to these events to compete. Interesting in the timing rules of this event. So they played six periods, six 10-minute running clock periods, and there's no substitutions. So you play 10 minutes, running clock, no subs, then quarter time comes or end the first period, then the next five kids jump off the bench, it's their turn to play 10 minutes, running clock. No subs unless there's an injury or an illness for a kid to come out, but the coaches aren't coaching subs, you're not worried about coming in and out of the game, so they're just coaching style of play, pace, 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 when you're open, and you'll see it. When a kid jumps up and sticks a jumper, it's like a party on the side of that court. Like, it's amazing. You see the coaches pumping their thing. That's the European passion that they play with. But the way they celebrate May jumpers is awesome. And that has a lot to do with the style of play that these kids are being put into and the environment they're being put into.
But the other part was the skill sets that we touched on. Incredible. Like, every pass was off the bounce.
Yep.
You know, good distance on the pass, able to pass off both hands on the move. Dribbling action was fluent and quick. And then shooting techniques. And I guess the big part of the shooting technique was the height of the rim. Which was, what was it?
Eight foot six.
So
as a point of reference, those that play on the ringleader systems, you can drop those down. So it's effectively what they are when they get dropped down, that height.
Yep.
Which was amazing.
Yeah, which again is a great thing to be able to keep form on your shot. I guess the things that we saw that were just kind of a little bit bemused by was three-pointers from mid-range distance. Like, they kind of had an error on the floor where they counted a kick out as a three-point make, which I like the idea of the three-point line, the spacing still in that. So that, to me, was, I get where you're coming from. But the ability to play with the style. And then the other part was, obviously, the 6'11", under 12 kid that could dunk everything, but
without jumping.
But what it was really good from a skill point was how the guards would look to pass it up high for him off the bounce, receiver spots. Like, it just naturally happened because he could dunk it, he could dominate that patch. But the other part to what you said, Zep, is, well, he can't be on all game, right? So you've got, you know, three periods there to be able to actually, no, this is when we'll get our score back, you know. So, no, I loved it. I love the lateral thing and the outside thinking of it, and the ability to just put something in place that is helping athletes get better.
Yeah, and with the big fella, who's actually Canadian-born, playing over there in that Frenchie Phenom team, he did not just park himself on the block, not to Justin's point. He was definitely moving with penetration, receivers principles, front of the rim, short corners, things like that. Now, for him to get from the short corner to the front of the rim took a little half step for him, but I think it was interesting, and it did train the guards to dropping it down and throwing it up to the big fella.
One of the bits I liked about that too is it wasn't just about him. Like, you watch that play when he's on the floor, and it's not just, hey, let's put him next to the rim, park him there and lob the ball in there at all. Like, that kid was pretty smart. He worked the receiver spots, as you're saying, Zeb. Like, he moved himself around. Guards were still allowed to be creative without, hey, our focus is the big fella, and we only throw it to him, and that's all we do. There was enough creativity to say, well, actually, if you get a lane, take the lane. Like, that's not a problem. And just the speed in which they moved the ball on was incredible.
Yeah.
Like, I've long been a fan of the two-second thing. Yep. When you catch it, if you can shoot it, great. If you can drive it, great. But don't be holding it for longer than 2 seconds. If you got it longer than that, you need to make the pass.
Got some of the scores from this event, Robbie. I know this is you don't like closeouts, so this is right up your alley. 96 to 104, 85 to 92, 112 to 82, 99 to 89, 89 to 79. One kid did get 40 points per game, it says right here. Does so help. Offense definitely dominating the defensive side of the ball, but that's 60 minutes running clock, which is which is a lot of points.
When in comparison, what was the score in the 14 girls game at the Classic at quarter time?
It was 5-0, Robbie. 5-2-0.
But that's, you know, that would be the interesting thing, is to put an under 12 game at this thing and an under 12 game here in Victoria side by side, and just look at how different the abilities and the style of play is. And that's not to say that, you know, our coaches under 12s aren't doing great work. Like, Rob, you're an amazing coach, but
my kids would beg to differ at this point.
But what it is about, you know, actually how, you know, modification can actually help the coaching and help the system and help the athlete. And you know, again, the score line there, like the European way is to score. You know, like they were the first ones about, you know, kicking it out and using the three, because they understood it's the same number of shots, but the US are dunking and we're gonna make an extra point each time. Like that. Scoring is a big part of how Europeans play, but that, I think, is a little bit of, you know, our history's been defense, 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 which I love, but now if we can pair that with that type of offensive mentality, well, now you've got a real great chance of winning any game you're in.
Absolutely, and I think the best rule that I thought was the modified height of the ring. Now, I'm not too sure what size basketball they play with on that either. Like, I haven't chased that up. Again, poor research on my hand. But I love the adjusted height of the rim, because now we can actually start to teach kids to shoot the ball correctly. They can value spacing on the floor and jump shooting as well, because that is really where the game is going. When we saw Houston was pretty much ISO ball through the NBA playoffs. But the reason they could do that is because they had four other shooters on the court, and if you helped off one of them, that thing was going up, and it's the value of the three-point shot.
Absolutely.
But I love the forward thinking of, well, you know what, we're not going to make an 11-year-old kid shoot on a 10-foot rim that our professional athletes play with. Like, we're going to modify that to make it easier, to make sure the technique is correct, the form is correct, and the understanding of when and why you shoot the ball is correct.
Yeah. And there's two parts to it. There's the catch and shoot. So you haven't got 12-year-olds being frightened that they're so far away from the basket that they have to chuck it up there. But then the other part is finishing at the basket. And what was evident, and I actually see this as a big thing on the female side of it as well, because finishing at the basket is something that I think everyone will admit needs to improve, both on the boys and the girls side. But the girls side, it is a massive point of difference. Teams that finish at the basket in the paint generally are pretty successful. Is the ability to jump off 1 foot and finish at the rim, which with a 10-foot basket is really hard to do. It's even hard just to comprehend, to jump off and power and finish at the basket. But with an 8'6" basket, these kids are attacking, they're jumping off 1 foot, it's powerful. There's a lot of Euro steps,
Offhand
finishes, off leg finishes. And that's just a product of them dropping
it. But it also helps that dunk mentality. Like, how many times you have a really good athlete that constantly just doesn't have that mindset? And, you know, that was the best thing I saw about that big kid, is he wouldn't think about laying it up. He's just going to try and dunk everything now. So he should, because he can touch the rim without jumping. But, you know, once he does start playing on a natural size rim, he's naturally going to be thinking, I'm trying to dunk everything. Mindset, that's a better outcome for him than, you know, if he's maybe started on that tall rim straight away and he's trying to fade away and whatnot.
Absolutely agree. So probably where I differ a little from you, Justin, is I actually quite like the idea of a closer three-point line. And we were discussing this in the office during the week. And it's on the back of our zone discussion. So I like the fact that threes, it was sort of mid-range-ish, wasn't it? So we sort of say,
it was probably mid-range.
12 to 14 feet, give or take, was where they counted their threes from. I actually like that, because inherently, the defensive team won't zone that. So realistically, if you want to sit in a zone, that's fine. That's just a mid-range shot for those kids on an 8'6" rim. You're taking your life into your own hands if you're going to pack the paint and sit in a zone, because that shot will go down easily now.
I definitely agree with what you're saying, but my counter would be, and it'd be interesting to know when they're really starting to work on the space in on the floor. And, you know, the more international play there is, the more that spacing gets deeper and deeper. Like, there's guys now standing 1.5 meters behind the three just to create that opportunity. So I know with our under 12 jamboree, we use the 3-point line not to be kicking up threes, but to have that understanding of space on the floor. Like, you've got to live behind that and then play with that. So that'd be my only kind of question around it is, then great idea on that, but then how are they teaching that space, and how are they helping that be part of who they are?
Well, I think it can still happen. You can still position yourself behind the three-point line and step into that shot now, which is probably a little bit more game-like. We were reading an article not too long ago about Philadelphia's use of the four-point line, which is, about 3 or 4 feet behind the three-point line, just to teach spacing and how to actually spread the floor when there's penetration and things like that. They still use the three-point line. I think it's just worth more when they step in, which I don't mind. Like, that's achievable, I think. If we would want to put that into our under 12 competition for, say, VJBL or domestic, we could possibly do something along those lines. Not everyone can adjust the rim size, like, completely get that. The basketball size probably could be. Yeah. Like, it's a discussion we've had a lot with the girls in particular. Like, it is crazy to think that an under 10 athlete, so 8 or 9 years old, is playing with the same size basketball that the Olympians play with in WNBA. Yeah,
so I know in SA, like, they used to drop it to 8 foot rims and use size fives for under 10s. I think for under 12s even, there's maybe an argument on the size five ball. Mm. And again, this is a purely skill development and fundamental development kind of chat, but that's going to help be able to make that one hand and push pass at pace down the floor and, you know, not have to pick up your dribble and all the sort of things that we preach a lot. But really, we, as you said, we're using the same equipment as fully grown women or men. So, there's some great ideas out of that tournament.
So what about practice? Like, it's going to be hard for us to change the rules this Friday night at VJBL, Robbie. But what about practice? Are we all, for myself and Justin, he's got his senior stuff as well, but, like, a lot of camp situations that we're in. There'll be a lot of listeners out there that are coaching at a domestic, a club. They might be in charge of a school program. They might run some camps this July school holidays. Like, what things can we do in those environments we're not going to change the fundamental game or the actual game itself, but what constraints and things can we do at practice to help influence skill development?
I think the big thing for mine, and I'm obviously living in this world coaching under 12s at the moment, we do a lot of disadvantage work. So we'll do a little bit of sort of 1-on-0 set shooting just to get the technique right, but then we live in pretty much disadvantage for the rest of the session. Right. Some would suggest I'm already disadvantaged because I'm coaching under 12s, but what I mean disadvantage is the numerical disadvantage. So the 2-on-1, the 3-on-2, the 4-on-3, the 5-on-4, and small-sided games learning. Like, it's, I've got 10 athletes in my team. I'm not a massive fan of having 10 kids in an under 12 team, just because even I struggle to get them all in, and I have an assistant coach who's on point, like, he knows what he's doing, but even I struggle to get 10 kids in. So for mine, it's keep your numbers smaller or break them down into smaller groups so they get higher reps. Like, 5-on-5, there are possessions, and you'll see it all the time, where kids don't touch the ball on 5 or 6 trips, whereas if you make that 3-on-3 or 4-on-4, 2-on-2, now they start to get more reps in, and it's been a little bit of a process, and the kids have actually done it inherently in my group. We're lucky that nobody trains before us on a Monday, Tuesday, whichever night it is that we train. They come in and it's now, okay, the first kid that turns up now starts taking mid-range jump shots rather than threes. So that's taken a little bit of work to break that. But as soon as the other kid turns up, or the second kid turns up, it's now 1-on-1. As soon as the next kid turns up, now it's 2-on-1. Mm-hmm. The next one, 2-on-2. And it just progressively evolves. And there have been plenty of times where we haven't started training until 5 or 10 minutes into when we're supposed to start training. But it's like, well, hey, they turn up and they play and they do their thing. Let them do it. Like,
the other one to me out of all that is, well, what are you trying to achieve as a coach that week? So one I love on that front, 1-on-2.
Yep.
So, your ball handling, your different type, how can you create separation? How can you get your contested finish at the rim? Different ways to manipulate what you're trying to work on. I think the other part, though, is when you're trying to emphasize a part of the game. So, it might be you're really working on kick aheads. Well, there's a bonus point for a kick ahead. Or, paint touches to kick out threes. Well, no, it's actually worth 4 than whatnot. Or your team's just not getting layups. All right, well, that's actually worth 5 points. Modifying score, but having score as part of it, because I think... Yep. If you're just playing and there's no outcome to it, that's a...
Gets old.
Yeah, that gets old. But also, you need to have kids that are competitive and know what the score is. Or I actually need to create a four-point make right now, whatever it might be. The other one that I've loved seeing, that I love using and have stolen off someone along the way was, your team doesn't box out. Well, if a team makes an offensive bucket and they can get the ball back, they keep playing at that hoop until the stop occurs. And so there's little things like that that you can do, that you've got a deficiency in your group. Well, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but here's some modifications that we can make to really make a point of emphasis on what we're trying to achieve.
And that's it. So we were talking about, as a collective, like modification of rules to spike player development. And then at a team level, absolutely. Like, what do you need to get better at? You can absolutely modify those rules. I like, and we do it at camps, so like working against a short clock. Like, there's 8 seconds on the clock, so you've got to make quick decisions. You've got to play fast. You're going to shoot that thing with 1 or 2 seconds left, and it's going to be contested. How's that going to look? And I think the more of those win or you lose, there's a make or a miss, environments helps.
And what you just said there is so important. Like,
thank you, man.
The worst thing when you go watch juniors, in my opinion, is 10 seconds to go on the shot clock, and everyone in the building's counting down 10, 9, 8. Like, there is so much time left in that offense. To me, great offense finishes in the last 4 seconds of an action. Like, if you've been at the first 8, or you're really working it out and trying to get down to that last 4, like, that's where the teams I coach try and live in. That, to me, is the advantage, like, actually not panicking in those moments and being able to find ways to still get a realistic, meaningful shot off. So, but again, it goes back to everything. If you don't do it in practice, you're not going to get good at it in that sense. 14-second shot clock games, like we were talking about that pre-pod, but that's something we use all the time to just, all right, you've got basically 2 sides of the floor to get a good look in. How are you going to create that? Figure out ways within your system to do that.
And the modifications are really the big thing. So you can do whatever drill you want, but the longer you do that, if there's no time and score involved in it, your kids are going to get bored. Like, eventually, they're just going to check out and go, hey, we've done this a million times, I'm not all that interested in it. So you do need a score, but the modifications are really the big things. So we've spoken on here a lot about, we play too many games as a whole. So our teams play too many games. But then we talk about, well, we need more small-sided games in training sessions. Yeah. And I understand, because a coach did hit me up about it, and it's like, you guys contradict yourselves all the time. It's
of
ridiculous.
Course we do.
Yeah, that's why we have this, so we can sit here and preach and not be held accountable.
That's like, the one-star review right there, Robbie.
It probably was. Where'd that come from again?
New South Wales.
Yeah. I'm fairly sure the mic picked that up, mate. But that is a really big thing. Like, kids will get better with competition. If you put them in an environment where they have to compete against someone, and you might modify it a little bit to, hey, we're going to play 1v1 from a wing catch. To start off with, the defense isn't allowed to steal the pass and just get it so that, now they can catch the ball, they can go and play from that, and then the defense can start playing. As the athletes get better at, now I can catch the ball comfortably, I understand what my pivots are from this point, I understand what I want to do. Well, now the defender can steal the pass, and then you start adding in an extra layer. Well, they can jump it and steal that. Now they can back up and then just start adding layers on top of that as well.
And that's exactly it. Because we probably all, when we first started playing, played one-on-one where you're not allowed to cross the lane line. Like, you got to play on the split line. Like, you're going to play one-on-one on the split. That's a modification.
Yeah. That's something I would say this at pro level. It drives me insane when the guy's like, no, they're playing on that side. I'm like, no. We want to play both sides at the same time because it's organized chaos. Like, you see someone there, you got to avoid it. Like, that's how the game is played. Back to your point as well, Rob, on there is a huge difference between playing a Friday night game and then playing games within practice environment, because, the 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 2-on-2 worlds, that's where a lot of the teaching can be done. And it's, no one's sitting out, no one's getting their 2-minute stint and then getting subbed out. It's like everyone's in on that thing. So that's what we mean by that.
That's the big point of difference.
When we're saying small-sided games, is every athlete's participating. It's mass participation. There's huge teaching within whatever you're doing at that point in time. That's not games to death. It's coaching.
And that's where we live culturally here in Australia, is that we execute 2 practices in a week, and it's like we need a game as a reward. Where the Euros have a completely different mindset on that. It's like practice. You might get a game next month on time.
Yeah, like, to me, it's somewhere in between. Like,
correct.
I love the way, the European leagues are, where you've got your mid-season, your midweek game, and your weekend league game, and so you are getting that, but they are still practicing every day. So I think there is somewhere in between it. You know, go back to what Eric said about competing our athletes into good development. Yeah. Like, that's what we've got to start avoiding is, no, it's actually the skill-based development that we give in practice environment that gets them better.
And I don't know if it's because you're very smart, Justin, or you just hit on it inherently, but the teaching word is so much more prevalent than coaching.
It's definitely because I'm smart.
Yeah, okay. We'll go with smart for now. Okay, but where I'm sort of heading with this is we can get lost is we all have the title of coach, and it's almost like you almost need to validate yourself as a coach by being up in active talking. And there's no problem with being active on the sidelines, but you have to teach within that. It's not, hey, that's a bad decision, go to the end of the line. Okay, why did you make that decision? And let the kid tell you why, because they might see something completely different to what you saw. And it's that whole push and pull communication. You can push your opinions onto people.
We might have read the same article.
We might have. Yeah, this might be where it came from. But you can push your opinion onto people, and then they really only understand your perspective from it. Like, or you can pull the information from them and ask questions and go, well, why did you do this? What was the reason behind making that decision and not that decision? And let them explain it to you, and their understanding and clarity will be far better.
I don't know if you have read this article or not, but like there was something I read recently that kind of made me really think about, more with the senior groups I work with, like, am I just coaching them or am I still teaching them? And it was a good, like, little reality check to go, I'm probably just coaching them at this point. Like, I need to actually get back to teaching a bit and breaking some things down. And, I think being able to constantly review and evaluate those sorts of things can really impact your practice a lot better.
And it's interesting, I was watching, and I won't say the coach because I don't know if they listened to this or not. No, it wasn't Zeppel. But I was watching a training session last year, and I watched the coach go through the training session and was really impressed with the session itself. Like, there was a lot of game-based learning, breakdowns, hey, disadvantage, do this, let's modify it, and we'll see how this goes. Then I watched the coach on a Friday night, and it was horrific. They just literally sat there on their hands and did nothing. So, well, you're probably undoing a little bit of the work that you're doing at your training sessions by not delivering feedback to the athletes in a game. So just because we say you need to teach, not necessarily coach and rant and rave on the sideline, there are variances with that. Like, you do need to still, you're in it with your kids. Like, you need to show them that you have their back and that, hey, there's a reason we go down this path, and you might not be performing the skill or the whatever it is correctly in a game, and you need to let them know that. And still, it's let them important. Figure it out, but they need the feedback as well. Like
with our Oz group, one of my rules is if an athlete comes out, they get some form of feedback, positive, constructive, whatever it may be. Like, they get hit with something when they go in, they get hit with something as well, like reminder, reinforcement, whatever, because of the age they're at. But also, that constant reinforcement of what we're trying to achieve is so vital. Like, and I do think it gets lost. Now, that helps the more staff you have, because that's definitely not me every time. That's, either of my assistants. But that stuff is pretty important. And the thing that I've always thought about with that is, well, then why is that different in a practice environment? And that's something I've tried to implement there is, a team comes out. So say you've got three teams going. The team that's not in the drill at that point, they should be getting feedback. There needs to be a point there where coaches are talking to them. And again, it could be positive reinforcement. It might be, this time we want you to hit X, Y, Z and make sure that that's there.
Absolutely.
I think it's valuable to allow your players to give feedback to each other as well. And obviously you can do that with the 16s, 18s, 20s, seniors. Probably your 12s and 14s probably won't deliver the best message, but empower your players to actually give feedback, because they're the ones experiencing it, and they could have more answers and conveyed in a better way than the coach can. So I do at times, don't always relate to a 10-year-old that I'm coaching. Like, mentally, I'm very much a 10-year-old at times, there is no question. But by and large, what I think makes sense to me will not necessarily make sense to the athlete. So there are times where we'll grab a kid out and say, well, okay, here's the drill, you explain it, and have them go through it. And it's like, oh, it's this drill where we have, three out, there's closeouts, we'll drive, and then we just pitch it and play. And it's like, well, okay, well, that makes sense to you. Cool. It should make sense to our athletes as well. Whereas if I say it, I'm probably going to overteach it, too many words, those kinds of things as well. You've got to empower your athletes a little bit to have a little bit of input.
The other one I like is if you've got three pillars or two pillars or one thing that your team's about, and the athletes review that at the end of each session and talk it out, because I've found myself often, I'm going, oh, that was a terrible practice, but the athletes actually think, well, no, we hit this, this, and this, or vice versa. I thought we've been great, and they've actually evaluated themselves a little bit lower, and just being able to get that gauge of, all right, well, what do we actually have to spend a little bit more time on, and what don't we, you know, is pretty important.
The feedback's an interesting one, Robbie. I would agree with you, so as long as there is really good teaching taking place. Like, if there's not really good teaching taking place, athletes will then just say anything.
Yep.
And I've seen this not work, like where teams have been empowered to hold each other accountable, provide feedback, coach each other, but because the teaching hasn't been great, it's been a complete mess. Yep. So if there's great teaching and there's great teaching cues and the environment is conducive to learning, it can work. But I'd be very, I'd be skeptical if you're kind of just trying to empower the players because you want them to do half your job for you as well, which is the way that I've seen it go.
Yeah, it does. And you can guarantee after every game on a Friday night, the first question is, hey, what did we do well? What did we do poorly? And you will get 9 different responses. Box outs will feature every time because they just think that, oh, we just don't box out. And so, well, actually, we did that really well tonight, but you guys think I'm always on your ass about that, and you have to say that. So your kids will mimic you. Yeah. If that's something that you constantly say to them, they will feed that back to you as well. So you do need to be a little bit careful about how much rope you give them along the way as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of other modifications or just sort of things that we can look at training sessions, one thing I'll throw out, removing age groups after under 16s. So probably under 10s play against 10s, 12s play against 12s, 14s play against 14s. Is there a possibility of potentially moving the under 16 and under 18 age groups and just say once you're out of under 14s, you're in the whole mess? And if you're a very good under 16 athlete, you can go and play under 18s. Like, you don't need to stay in your age group. What does that hurt? Why hold a kid back if they're good enough to compete against better? So you look at the Doncic kid that's playing over in Europe at the moment. He's been playing EuroLeague for how many years now? Like 3 or 4. So Rubio was playing at 15.
That to me is more, I think there is something about junior levels. I'm not sure we've got them right, but you know, I kind of think more levels in my head might be a little bit better. But that's there's a roadblock for the best kid to be able to play senior basketball. And, you know, the comment I hear a lot on women's Siebel, and you're in it more than me, and I avidly don't sit there pre-game and watch, so I can't really truly say this, but that it's such a young league now and there's too many young players in there that the standard's dropped. Well, so what is the solution on that? And to me, you know, like, blue chip is blue chip, and that athlete should be able to play, you know, senior basketball as soon as they possibly can. But then there's got to be levels underneath where you're also at your level to a suitable point. I don't know, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, my only concern with that would be, yeah, if you're a blue chipper playing seniors, then Luka Doncic was not also playing in the under 17s team.
Yep.
That would be my only argument on that. I do think that's, and it is, so in the US, when you're in the high school varsity team, you've got 9th graders through 12th graders. Like, you're just amongst the mess, like Robbie just said. And if you're in Germany, if you're in the U19 team as a 16-year-old, then you're just in the U19 team as a 16-year-old. So I think it's an interesting, really interesting concept. I think what they do in AAU basketballs like this, and obviously like the events that you know, we watched during the week, they have a 2006 born competition, and that's it. Like, it's not under 14s, it's 2006 born, and these are the 2006 born kids playing against each other. So that's an interesting thing to think about too.
That's kind of more, I guess, where I'm thinking. Like, you know, why isn't it just year by year?
Yeah.
Because then, and I always do believe, like, if a kid is too good for a level, they should be able to move up.
Correct.
I absolutely believe that, and
you're
100% that you add a level, you don't, you remove a level. Like, you don't do everything. But yeah, to me, it's sort of, especially I think of it more now because of under 15s coming in. So there's an under 15 event, there's an under 16 event, under 17 event now for junior national teams, and I just keep going, well, you know, maybe there should be a 14s, a 15s, a 16s, a 17s age group, and that would, you know, those kids obviously flow through, but does that actually help our athletes more than just trying to bunch them all together for 2 years in the same bracket? I'm not sure.
Like,
I have no idea, in all honesty. Just throwing it out there. Trying to give you two wise people an opportunity to talk.
The other thing, and it's less of a constraint on practice, it's more of a just something that I've seen work pretty well in the past. I've seen it work offensively and defensively, and I know, Robbie, you're a bit of an advocate for it, is marking on the floor, your spots on the floor. Like whether that's receiver spots, you know, if you do have your diagonal, your drift, your dunker spot highlighted or taped up, or you've got little discs that you can pop on the floor, or if you've got defensive positions that you might want to mark up or push points or whatever it is, I do think that using some kind of diagram-ish thing on the floor can help athletes learn and play within those constraints.
Yep, we use cones a fair bit at under 12s practice, obviously, because if I go and tell a kid to stand on the wing, their definition of the wing is very different to my definition of the wing. And
the blue cones, yeah, stand on the blue cones.
And even that's tough. Like, those kids pick those things up, wear them as hats constantly. Like, the wing changes to half court constantly.
You did say
like
they copy you quite a bit.
Yeah,
right?
I lead by a very poor example, to be fair to say, but I find that having cones of practice is vital. Like, it's the only way I can control 10-year-old kids is to have cones out. And it's like, hey, two people to each cone. And they can go there straight away. And it's like, hey, now come on, we've got three there and we need to shift this around. But it is great for our spacing, because anyone that's watched an under 12 game, it is a rolling mess. Like, it looks like rugby at times, because all 10 kids on the floor will just crowd the ball. And hey, you know, I want the ball, so I'm going to go and run over to the person that already has the ball and ask for it, rather than actually I'm going to create space on this, let them drive, and then they can find me. It's so hard to teach, but I find cones and spacing does help with that a fair bit.
If you can mark on the floor receiver spots and then defensive cue points, like, that'd be a great development tool for gameplay. Like, if you owned your building and you could do that, that'd be a real advantage, I think, for athlete development.
There are some gyms you walk into and there are lines all over the place anyway, so it's like, hey, find the turquoise line and that's the one that you need to be standing on, but it is difficult.
It's actually something I say to athletes whenever we travel. The first thing you need to identify is what colour is the basketball court line, especially when you play in Europe, like there's handball courts or whatnot. Like, you need to know what colour line you're playing on.
Yep, absolutely.
Take that to your Nunawading tournaments.
Okay. Don't know where that one's come from, but all right. So we have got coming up in these school holidays an under 12 showcase. So this is probably where this has come from. I suppose we were discussing sort of rule changes.
Where it came
the
from,
week.
He copied the country program, but that's okay.
Okay, so for those of you unaware, Vic Country do have a jamboree that runs you guys' September school holidays, I believe. So how many athletes do you have in that?
So 200 boys, 200 girls, come out of skills days across country Victoria. And it's basically a selection process. You need to be identified to continue through the path. Has been running a long time before I got here, but probably in my 5 years, we've tried to turn that into a bit of a pathway development tournament. It originally started as it was a fun event, and it still is. Like, five on, five off, like Zep was talking about, you know, halfway mark of the game, it's total sub, four quarters, so it's as close to a normal game as possible. We implement style of play, and basically style of play is just those receiver spots. Teach them how to play with space, how to I guess operate down the country path of what we're trying to do. The things out of this week, it's kind of got me thinking about is, well, what else could we adjust with it to help that and aid that? But
that's where our mad scientist, Mike Zeppel, has come to town with his showcase. So Zeppel has taken basketball and stripped it apart. James Naismith will be turning in his grave at the moment, but I kind of like where he's heading with this. Zeppel, do you want to take us through what your plans are for this under 12 showcase down at the home of
basketball, Robbie?
Basketball, Werribee, over the school holidays?
It's actually been renamed, Robbie. It's going to be called the Villa della Werribee showcase. We're going to experiment with a few things, Robbie. So we're going to go 5 periods, 10 minutes per period, not quarters, Justin, because there's 4 quarters.
That's right.
There's 5 periods. The first 4 periods will be 10-minute running clock. No subs, just sub on at the end of each period. And the fifth quarter, we'll play the last 2 minutes stop clock. Okay. But in the last period, the fifth period, coaches can sub. Okay. So that's the only chance to sub within the game will be in the fifth period. We will play on the lower baskets. 8'6" basket, so we'll see how that one plays out. Mentioned substitutions. I like the check ball. Okay, so I spoke to the... We're going to get the games officiated. Spoke with the referees department, so they're going to be fine with that. They're just hoping that the athletes understand that that's going to be the rule. But we'll talk about that day one at camp. So if a foul gets called, travel, turnover, athlete just grabs the ball, runs to the sideline and can inbound that thing straight away. We are going to experiment with the reduced three-point line, Robbie. So our markings are going to go from the elbow, like the new elbow, to where the netball circle intersects with the baseline. So it's going to be a little bit different there.
You've already annoyed
Take that to the jamboree, mate. Take that to the jamboree, mate. And this one, love this one, Robbie. No full court zone press at all in the Villa Della Werribee this time, Robbie. So full court man picker, absolutely. You can pick up the ball, but there won't be any zones or zone presses. We'll just encourage spacing. And the directive to the coach is going to be pretty simple. Like a kid that's open to catch and shoot the ball, just catch and shoot the ball. Yeah. If you draw two people to the ball at any one stage, get rid of the ball and give your teammate a chance to make a play. And really that's it. Like just be skilled, throw the ball up the floor, play fast.
That's when we talk style of play. That's it. Yeah. C2, give it up. On the kick out, you can either shoot it or you've got to make an extra pass. You can't re-penetrate. And that's where that kind of stops with it. And no full court press is a big one. Like that's been the key to what we've done with the Jamboree. But the thing that I've tried to encourage is basketball reads. So if an athlete sees a kid's got his head down and just dribbling to the corner, well, you can run and jump it. So we allow that part of it because I think that's kind of basketball IQ, but actually run a formal press, no way.
So 100 boys, 100 girls, Robbie, is a little bit smaller than the show and then the Jamboree, but we've got 100 boys and 100 girls taking part.
Well, and this is the first time it's been run on the metro side of things, as you say, Justin, sort of following the country method as well. We're going to video these games and try and get a few stats from it as well and just sort of find out, like, okay, do these modifications actually work? Are they going to produce better athletes? Will they produce better athletes for maybe 3 or 4 days? Then they go backwards again, like what actually comes out of this. So we'll be sort of interested to see the findings on this as well.
That's probably something I should bring up with the Jamboree. That's also a great point for us to influence coaching. So what we've found is the athletes that go from the Jamboree that then go into an association environment where they're getting the same teachings and ideology progress into our 14s academy really quick and then into state players. The athletes that go from the Jamboree to associations that maybe haven't bought in, they may make academy, but they tend to not be quite there by state time at under 16. So it has been interesting in tracking over 5 years that trend of it. So I'm sure that'll be something you'll see out of the metro side of it as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting just to see, like Robbie said, you'll be able to do a bit of like data analysis, like easy just to see the scores of the games, and you know, you might be able to stat a couple of the games just to get an idea of field goal percentages and things like that. But there's also going to be the, you know, the visual, like watching some of these games, just like we did with this Spanish game on tape, like watching it and seeing what does it actually look like, what does the style of play look like out there, what is the space, because I think there'll be no set plays. Like there won't be a single play drawn up for the whole week. What does it look like when kids just have to go out there and make a basketball play?
Yep, it's the easiest way to get sacked is to overcoach at this showcase, I'd suggest. And like Zeppel will be fairly ruthless if you start running out horn sets with these under 12 kids.
Ruthless, Robbie.
Ruthless. All right, so that moves us on. So if you do have any thoughts or ideas, by all means, hit us up with the hashtag TalkingSplit on Twitter. We'll get anything from there and share it out. If we think it's a good idea, we'll probably end up in the showcase next year. If it's a terrible idea, then Zeppel will come after you on Twitter and go from that point. We are into the split this week. So the split this week, so I'm trying to word this the correct way. Zeppel.
You should, because yeah, you came up with it.
Yeah, I know. Again, a very poorly produced one this week. I haven't done much research.
Our producer, mate. You are our producer.
Zeppel, are you best off being the best player on an average team? Or Justin, are you better off being a good player on a good team? Give me the four argument. Mike, you can start.
Thank you, mate. I will. I think 100%, shadow of a doubt, you are better off being the very good player on a team that finishes middle of the pack. Like, I think your greatest chance at development is to, again, it comes back to a lot of these constraints and tweaks to practices and games, is to have the ball in your hands more often than not, having to make plays more often than not, and being somebody who, if your team wants to win the game, you've got to be really, really good. And I think what would be interesting is to see exactly where a lot of our star athletes, not just basketball, star athletes from Australia come, because I would hazard a guess that a lot of them come from smaller associations, country towns, and not the metropolis, where they're the big fish in a kind of smaller pond. I do think there's a lot to that, and there's been books written about that exact argument. So the thing that does trouble me here, and you see it, it's really prevalent, is kids changing clubs. Listen to a great podcast this week on, it's called The Talent Equation, and they spoke about, like, changing clubs and moving from, it was about Canadian soccer, and moving from club to club or association to association. Like, what does that even mean for a 14 or 15-year-old? And where's the necessity in that? So definitely I think you're better off being the best player on a team that finishes middle of the pack.
Justin?
It's a pretty good argument, Zep. The biggest,
white flag has gone up already.
No, not at all, because the biggest point of difference to me in being the good player in the good team means you've got the good coach. So if more athletes are getting developed, there's a reason for that. Playing with other like-level athletes is the quickest way to escalate your development. So while in gameplay there's definitely benefit to what Zeb said, I think in practice environment there's a lot more benefit in being part of the good team, where you're going against the same level athlete and just getting that high-end coaching. So to me, you know, I think there's a huge strength in being in that scenario. I also think if you're in the good team, you tend to get noticed by national selectors more, and being able to have a better understanding of where a talent level is at. You know, often the athlete that's dominant in the team that's at the bottom of the table, while they look like a nice athlete, there's always question marks around, you know, do they actually make others better? Can they fit into a team system, etc.? So I think there is, it's a good argument either way, I believe, but to me, being good in the good team, there's probably a few more benefits there.
Did well, mate. Good comeback.
Not bad.
Good comeback.
That was actually a reasonable question. No, there,
Robbie
Rob,
did like his that, job once.
That was a, finally, there was actually a two-way argument.
So you two do remember I can edit the crap out of this thing afterwards, and I can make Robbie. You sound however I need to make you sound. But the Justin Shuler soundboard could be one of epic
you
proportions at the end of this. Kick. You, Justin.
The kick. All right, so we started with one. We changed it to another. I'm going to say both because I can't.
Okay.
I can't. So we're going to start with mock drafts. So right now, the NBA needs to be relevant because the final series was just a snore. Zep, you were miles off with your Cavs in 7 prediction. I think I was the closest with Golden State in 5. So
could not have been further off.
Win a winner, chicken dinner. But the thing that is amazing with mock drafts right now, and I think it goes for any sport when you look at it, is how people just get picked apart. Not often is it spoken about what they... You know, what the greatness of what they do, it's more about what they can't do. Upside is the most used word. And,
ceiling.
You know, like, yeah, yeah, like, so Luka Doncic is the athlete I'd probably compare this with, listening to a few things lately where his draft stock is dropping. Comparisons of him to college athletes putting up the same stat line, well, he's playing nearly 100 games a year where they're playing around 30. So, you know, and to be able to do it on a bigger sample size against grown men who it's a professional league, you know, like I think there's something in that. It just baffles me that that's how it goes. I think it's an interesting discussion, and I love talking to NBA execs when I get the opportunity to about why they go certain paths with things and, you know, like the science behind it and the understanding. But, yeah, to me right now it's a talking head world. And, you know, Mo Bamba, who we had the pleasure of playing against last year. Like, if you were going to tell me at that point in time that he was going to potentially be the number one pick, I definitely didn't see that. So I'm not saying he shouldn't be, but, you know, just to hear he had a great workout, Now he's the number one pick. Where you look at his season, you know, it's an interesting world. So that's the first kick.
It is. I'll just chip in real quick. Like, it is interesting. I'm looking at a mock draft right now, and Trae Young's moved all the way to number three, and Doncic has dropped to five. So, like, wow. If you're comparing, like, international point guard versus college freshman point guard who essentially lost 14 of his last 16 games of his season, like, yeah. And it's not to say here nor there, but have that conversation with someone in the know, like, okay, why? Because we're talking about talent ID. Like, we live this. Why Trae Young over Luka Doncic when we're looking at 6'7 point guard, international experience, la, la, la. Just why? And just to see how this thing's going to play out.
The other part to all this is, if I'm some of these athletes, I'm really hoping I drop to certain teams or go up for certain teams. Like, I think there is something about
situation
where
matters.
You get drafted to. Do you get an option? Like, Tatum's a great example. Like, we played against him in 2014, and the only person being spoken about as a true NBA superstar at that point was Malik Newman. Now, he still has a chance to do that. But Tatum wasn't the guy being spoken about in that front. And then I look at, well, he got picked up purely by chance where he did because of
went to Duke, was on a good team at Duke.
Yeah.
Like, good player on a good team.
Exactly. Found another way there. But then gets picked by the Celtics, you know, in a situation where the player that was playing his spot injures himself in the first play. Like, so does he become the athlete he is if he didn't get those trial and error reps on the floor? So there's a lot of that at this time of year, and I think it's interesting. Like, I actually enjoy the draft, seeing where things go, but it's more about the summer league and seeing how quick they kind of actually look like they're going to be a player or whether it's a project. The other kick,
which was quite an
entertaining kick, I must say. I did watch the whole thing, sadly, but the Big Baller Brand film clip that came out, and just, like, straight away my thought goes to, what is this guy trying to do to his career? Like, is he trying to railroad his own career or what?
No, and if he's not, his dad probably is.
Yeah, like, you know, just the whole, you know, what the hell is that? Like, and Rob, you got more info on this thing.
Yeah, so the Lakers have come out today and have had to bring in both Kuzma and Ball and say, hey, no more of this. You're actually damaging the Laker brand. Like, and it started off pretty funny. Like, I must admit, there were some Snapchats that flew around, like some Twitter news stories and things like that, where they'd just be pranking each other. And I must admit, like, it started off as pretty funny. But it's just gone way out of control, where you got to honestly start thinking about the mental state of these guys. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, this is your off season where you're supposed to be getting better.
I remember,
and this is what you do.
I remember as a kid when, like, you know, Shaq's making movies, apart from Blue Chips, one of my favorite movies.
Shaq Fu wasn't great.
But, you know, like the Kazam or whatever it was, and then Dennis Rodman's in Double Team. I'm like, why aren't you guys working on your game? Like, like, what's going on here? And just this whole thing, like, to me, Lonzo, well, get in the gym and just work out. Stop doing this sort of stuff.
Fix that jumper.
Yeah, like, I mean, that to me is the kick. Like, just get better in the gym, not in your film clip game.
The extra, Mike.
The extra, Robbie. Not sure if you guys heard, LeBron to the Pelicans is a real, real thing. So I'll just keep. We'll be on LeBron watch on Talking Split for a little while now. But that's about done.
Hang on. On a LeBron watch, did you hear that Gary Payton was talking about
his kid's
best mate's dad has a job offer in Dallas, and that's why LeBron's leaving.
I did hear that.
The Cavs, like, that one cracked me up.
I did hear that.
Gary Payton's never been short of running his mouth either, it'd be fair to say.
The glove would be a good guest on.
He'd be fantastic. We wouldn't have to do anything. We'd just sit here and let him go.
Make that happen, Robbie. Make that happen.
Don't roll that deep.
The extra. Look, we've been good in the Justin Shuler stitch-up. This season, it's ridiculous. Been fun more than anything, but we do need to send him on a cheerio. This will be his last pod off next week to Argentina.
Not of all time, just
just this season. We'll see how good.
Really,
he might be permanently on the bench, but just a extra good luck to Justin and the team, the under 17 Crocs boys over in Argentina. Obviously, wish them all the best, and the girls will be heading to Belarus as well soon. So all the best to both of those teams with a bunch of Victorian athletes in there, hoping they all play and coach well.
No, thanks, Zip. Well, the new trophies got released by FIBA today, and it just kind of made it a little bit more real. And but we head into Argentina for three practice games, the French, Canada and Egypt as leading games, and then yeah, tournament's underway. So 16 days now till the first real game against Dominican Republic for us. So yeah, exciting. Hoping the
we will do
as planned. Picked up some new swag this week. I'm led
we
to
did.
As well.
Yeah, need to do a big shout out to Peak and Matthew Delladova for hooking up the boys with some Delhi ones and stuff. So yeah, we'll be sporting them the whole time. Get a little photo out on the socials on that one. But yeah, no, a huge thing. I think it's just really cool. Like, the kids can't wait to wear them, and you know, that's Delhi who's gone this path, and now we're able to do that. So no, big appreciation to that.
And we'll of course be following the progress, making ridiculous.
First game, I think, is 2 a.m. in Australian time, so I expect you guys to be tuning in.
And if we don't watch, we'll check the box score and we'll make rash snap decisions on how you went during that game as well.
I'm sure you will.
But obviously, good luck to you and also the crew heading across. And that wraps us up for this week. So we are back next week. We are Justinless, but we got used to that over the weeks. You know, dealing with
there's one thing we will know: it will be a ratings bonanza.
It will be. It will be. But again, thanks everyone for listening. If you can, please leave a rating or review on iTunes.
Subscribe, Robbie.
Is also a very big thing. We're trying to work out how the iTunes ratings work. We have no idea. We've left in the trusty hands of Craig Freeman here. We forgot to put our podcast up last week. He sends his apologies, everyone.
He's a little guy. We got to lay off him.
If you can, please do interact with us online as well. Like, share, retweet, all those sorts of things as well to try and grow the podcast a little bit as well. Any questions or rule modifications that we spoke about before, just hit us up on Twitter with the hashtag TalkingSplit, and we'll catch you guys next week.